The United States says it will ban all shipments of palm oil from two of the biggest producers in the world. They're both Malaysian-owned. The ban comes in the wake of Associated Press investigations exposing widespread labor and human rights abuses in the palm oil industry. 80% comes from Malaysia and Indonesia. Palm oil is found in everyday products and food, including Girl Scout cookies, Tom's of Maine toothpaste, which is owned by Colgate, and Lysol cleaners. So what effect will these bans have? What else is needed to protect workers and regulate this industry? Join us after the news. Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls One Planet series. Last month, the United States said it will ban all shipments of palm oil from one of the biggest producers in the world. The producer is Malaysian-owned. The order was announced 3 months after the U.S. slapped the same ban on another Malaysian palm oil giant. These two bans come in the wake of Associated Press investigations exposing widespread labor and human rights abuses in the industry, which is worth a whopping $65 billion. 85% of the world's palm oil comes from Malaysia and Indonesia. The AP interviewed more than 130 current and former workers from two dozen palm oil companies. Reporters found everything from rape and child labor to trafficking and outright slavery on plantations in both countries. Children as young as five are being forced to work for free or little pay and are routinely exposed to dangerous chemicals. Child labor in Indonesia and Malaysia is tied to palm oil in 70% of products made from some of the world's well-known brands, including Oreo cookies, which is owned by Nabisco, Kit Kat bars, is owned by Nestle, and Lysol cleaners. Palm oil is also in Girl Scout cookies, personal care products from L'Oreal, Procter & Gamble, and Tom's of Maine toothpaste, which is owned by Colgate. Some of the world's top banks and financial institutions are pouring billions of dollars into the palm oil industry, including Deutsche Bank, Citigroup, and HSBC. Joining us with the latest on these investigations are two guests. Margie Mason is a medical and investigative reporter for the Associated Press. Hi, Margie. Thanks so much for joining us again.
Hi. Thanks for having me back.
We're also joined by Robin McDowell, an investigative reporter with the Associated Press. Hi, Robin. Thank you so much for joining us.
No, thank you.
Margie Mason and Robin McDowell were part of the AP team that won a Pulitzer in 2016 for the series Seafood from Slaves. Well, back in December, Margie, we had you on talking about this investigation, and since then, the United States says it will ban all shipments of palm oil from two of the biggest producers in the world. How important is this development, and how did this come about?
Well, this is the second, as you mentioned, the second ban that U.S. Customs and Border Protection put in place. The first one was in September, and that was also against a Malaysian company, FGV Holdings. And the second one was at the end of December, and that was against Sime Darby. And these two companies are two of the biggest palm oil producers in the world. And I think that the U.S. is sending a message, or trying to send a message, to Malaysia and Indonesia that they're now looking at this industry, and it's something that they are paying close attention to, and that they really want the countries and the producers to take a look at what they're doing, and to try to clean up some of the labor abuses that have been known for a while, and that we certainly have documented in our reporting.
Can you tell us more about how this decision was made? Who was behind this?
Well, what happened is, with this last one, there was a nonprofit group, an anti-trafficking group called Liberty Shared, And they had submitted a petition last year. They had done their own work and found a number of labor abuses. And then they alerted U.S. Customs and Border Protection about this. And they then did their own investigation, which, of course, you know, they released the results of their investigation right around the time that we released the results of ours. So this is how the decision was made. You know, they didn't make the decision based solely or at all on our investigation. They did their own investigation and found that there were problems as well.
Robin, what would you add? How significant is this? And when we say the United States will ban all shipments of palm oil from two of the largest producers, can you just describe what that means exactly? How will that work?
Well, I agree with Margie. This is largely a symbolic move. In terms of the U.S. market, it is rather small for Malaysia and Indonesia. But they do recognize that this is, you know, there's a lot of attention and focus on all these multinational companies highlighting the fact that there are labor abuses or that they have found them is not the kind of reputation they want to have. And it also could impact buyers in Europe as well. So I think it's largely symbolic, but it will, and I think in many cases, companies can get their palm oil from other companies. They might switch to different producers while they're waiting. In some cases, that happened already with FGV Holdings, but they can get palm oil. If they need it, they will get it.
Right. And this is really important to point out, because in one of the videos that you did, and then these are on our website, yourcallradio.org, you point out that the palm oil is not always called palm oil on the label. There are many other names for it. And so as a citizen, if you care about this issue, you might not know that palm oil is in your product. Robin, Margie also pointed out in our last show that it's hard to, quote, follow the palm oil sometimes. So if you want to know, you know, if you're using Tom's of Maine toothpaste and you want to know where this palm oil comes from, sometimes it's just impossible to trace it back to a specific plantation, right?
Yeah, that's correct. And I think that's especially true with personal goods and cosmetics. The names are hidden under more than 200 different names. And I think many times the companies are working through suppliers, third-party suppliers. So they might not immediately know themselves if it's palm oil and where it comes from.
Can you remind us, Margie, about how palm oil products are often obscured by many names? In the video, palm oil is also called hydrogenated palm glycerides, ethyl palmitate, octyl palmitate. There are just many names for palm oil.
Right. So when you're dealing with, especially when you're dealing with cosmetics and personal hygiene products, oftentimes the palm oil will go through many different, it will go through many different refining and there's a lot of processes. And so in doing so, you get the derivatives of the original crude palm oil. And they can rename it, and they do rename it. And there's many different derivatives of palm oil. And so, you know, you get all of these really long names. If you look on the back of, say, a shampoo bottle, you see many names there that you have no idea what those are. And I think that's, you know, even trying to decipher of those which ones are probably palm oil can be difficult, because as we ran into when we would call the companies and ask specifically, is this palm oil? They would say, well, maybe, but it could be coconut or it could be some other type of vegetable oil. But largely palm oil is the cheapest and it is, you know, a huge crop. So most companies are going to have palm oil if you find it, you know, on the back of the bottle. But it is really, really hard to know 100%.
As you both report, this is a $65 billion industry. The invisible women of this industry make $2 a day with no health benefits. Several women spoke with you secretly so they could speak openly. So if this ban is largely symbolic, Margie, is this going to change the working conditions for any of these men, women, and children?
I think that's a really good question. That's certainly our hope in shining a light on this problem. We opted not to kind of go after or zero in on one particular palm oil producer or one particular company, because we found in going to more than two dozen companies, we found that the problems were so widespread that we felt like we wanted to basically shine a light on the whole industry. Now, I think the big question is whether or not there's going to be enough pressure, whether the governments are going to feel this pressure, whether the companies are going to feel this pressure. And I think that any change that comes, it's certainly not going to be, it's not going to be fast.
And Robin, obviously the companies and the governments would feel the pressure if they knew that reporters like you were watching them on a regular basis, because Margie told us just how difficult this story was to report and the why this doesn't get that much attention, because these plantations are remote. I mean, it takes months and months of on-the-ground work to do an investigation like this. So, Robin, what are your plans for follow-up to find out if these bans have made any difference for the people working in this industry?
Well, one thing I'd really like to stress is that the bans are a good first step. One of the reasons we felt it was important to write so extensively on this issue is because consumers do have a lot of power. I don't think boycotting palm oil is the answer, but because it's almost impossible to boycott. It is in your, you know, from the moment you wake up in the morning until you go to bed, you are engaging with it in one way or another. But they can pressure the companies to put more pressure on the Malaysian and Indonesian governments to improve governance over this industry. They can pressure their banks, their pension funds, all the other, the Western financial institutions that are helping prop up the industry. And I think that is where you're going to start seeing, you know, greater change than one or two companies being banned by the United States. In terms of follow-up, I think that, you know, we've heard a little bit already about companies that are expressing interest or concern about the women. I think, you know, it would be possible for them to do things like demand that there's women supervisors in the fields, or put pressures on the companies to have some sort of oversight outside of the company themselves, women's NGOs, things like that.
And in terms of banks, have you heard anything from the funders? You report that Duncan Jepson of the anti-trafficking group Liberty Shared said the U.S. ban should be a red flag for Asian and Western financial institutions that have helped support this industry, saying ties to forced labor could have serious consequences for banks and lenders. And some of the most well-known banks that are funding, pouring billions into this industry, include Deutsche Bank, Citigroup, and HSBC. So, Robin, have you heard anything from these financial institutions?
Well, we did reach out to them before the story published and gave them a chance to comment. They responded the way most companies responded. That was, we're members of the Sustainability Global Association. We count on the suppliers to monitor these kind of behaviors and basically pass the buck. But I think that is one thing that the ban by the U.S. government might have an impact. I mean, you are seeing now that even the United States government is talking about, are raising flags about forced labor. And, you know, some of these companies are indirectly involved. Some of them are directly involved. Some of them are providing money to, for instance, Maybank, which provides the, you know, payrolls for some of these workers. So I think they do have something to be concerned about at this moment. And we're really hoping that these stories put pressure on them and no longer allow them to just ignore it and pretend like it's not really their problem.
Margie, anything to add on the financial institutions?
Yeah, I think that this is a really important issue. And we talked about this last time as well. The banks have a lot of influence here. They hold a lot of power because they're the ones that are supplying the money for the expansion. So I do think, you know, that if consumers and customers, and again, you know, they're also going to be seeing what we've done. They're also going to be seeing what the U.S. government is doing. So, you know, we'll be watching that very closely to see if any banks start, you know, striking some of these palm oil companies, you know, from their lists.
Now, we know that these companies collectively, depending on if it's a food company, a personal care products company, they have strong lobbies in Washington, D.C. What about the palm oil industry lobby? Robin, do you know if they have a lot of power in Washington, D.C.?
To be honest, I don't know if that's an issue, but I know that the companies themselves are the ones that want this palm oil. So they're not being pressured by palm oil lobby to get it. They want it, you know, not only because it's cheap, as Margie said, but it's also really the ideal commodity for some of their products. And once they got hooked and using it, you know, for ideal properties in making lipstick or the bubbles in shampoo, they're not going to need pressure from the palm oil lobby to continue wanting to get it.
Well, let's talk about why this industry has exploded so quickly. Margie, can you just give us a little bit of the backstory about how we got to a place where palm oil is in so many everyday products now?
Yeah, so palm oil is literally, again, you've mentioned many different things that it's in. It's in a lot of the snack foods. It's in baby formula. It's in paint. It's in pesticides. It's in shampoo and conditioner and soap. It's in so many different things. And it is, as Robin just said, it's extremely versatile, and it's very cheap. And it's also, to produce it, the yields are higher for palm oil than for any other vegetable oil. So there's a lot of attractive qualities about it. In the United States, it really took off after trans fats were banned. So food manufacturers, they needed to find an alternative. And palm oil was there, and it worked, and you know, it really became the go-to oil. And it is. It's almost magical, as we explained in the story. It just you know, it doesn't spoil, it doesn't produce a lot of smoke if you're frying with it. So it's used in things like donuts, you know, it's used in the production of breads. You know, to keep them fresher. So there's just so many different uses for it, and it has exploded. And as Robin mentioned, the United States uses it in all of these products, and yet still the amount used here is much smaller than, say, in India and China, which use it largely for frying. So they're the two of the biggest consumers of palm oil.
That is Margie Mason. Today we're speaking with Margie and Robin McDowell, investigative reporters at the Associated Press. They interviewed more than 130 current and former workers from two dozen palm oil companies and found everything from rape and child labor to trafficking and outright slavery on plantations in Malaysia and Indonesia. If you have any questions or comments for Margie and Robin, I know we got so many emails last time around. You can email us your call at kalw.org. We're already getting a lot of questions for the both of you. Before we get to questions, a few more basic facts. Robin, overall, do you know how many people actually work in the palm oil industry?
Those numbers are very hard to come by. It's been one of the biggest challenges. And a part of it is because so many of the workers are not counted. So the official government figure in Indonesia is 16 million, but there's many people, including children and some of the women, who are not counted among those. Malaysia is also very challenging because they rely very heavily, almost exclusively, on migrant workers. And many of those come in without documents or, you know, move around from company to company. And so they are much harder to count.
And as you report, the women, you have a whole piece that's just devastating, but also just, I mean, the photos are really amazing. The photos of the plantation farms, the palm oil fruit itself. You have a photo, and I should give credit to Binsar Bakara. A young girl collects palm oil fruit on a plantation in Sumatra. I mean, you have the video of these women holding a tube of lipstick that is bought here in the United States, who are actually just shocked at the price. You report that the invisible women who work on these plantations make about $2 a day with no benefits, no job protections. Is that the price across the board for those who actually are paid, Robin, about $2 a day?
It really varies a lot. So I think that is really on the low end for, you know, male workers will make quite a bit more. And it really depends on the company itself. So the women and the children are really those that get the least and are basically helping their fathers or husbands meet really impossibly high quotas set by the companies. So they're kind of the extra helpers in most cases. And some of them don't get paid at all. Mm.
We have a number of emails from listeners. Susan writes in, what can we do? Just tried emailing Citibank to demand they drop palm oil. No luck yet. What can we do? Margie, do you want to take that first?
I think that's the question that everyone keeps asking us. And, you know, it's difficult because there's no easy answer. I think, obviously, the pressure and trying to, if you can, decipher what's in the products that you use. But again, as Robin mentioned, I don't really think that boycotting it is the answer either, because it's at this point too big to fail. So it's in everything. That's not going to change. So, you know, I think as journalists, this is a very difficult question for us to answer, because we, you know, our role is to shine a light on this problem. And we don't have, you know, the magic answer. I think that now what we've done is we've done our jobs. We have put a light on this. And so now it's up to consumers to put the pressure on, because they have the power. It's up to the companies that are using this palm oil to put the pressure on. And it's up to governments to put the pressure on and to try to force change within this industry. But again, it's not going to be easy, because some of these things, these systems have been in place. The quota system that Robin just mentioned has been in place for generations. And so these things are going to need to change. And, you know, women have largely not really had any leadership roles in the palm oil industry. And so that's also something that could be a positive change.
What would you add, Robin?
I don't really have much to add to that.
All right. Well, thank you. We have a number of emails coming in from listeners who want to know what to do. Be sure just to share the stories, the videos, and as Robin said, to reach out to these companies. We do have an email about a company, Dr. Bronner's. Philip wrote in and said, I use Dr. Bronner's soaps partly because they present themselves as using palm oils ethically. I wonder if that is really the case for their products. And I just looked on their website. Dr. Bronner's in 2016, they have a page that says Dr. Bronner's sources palm oil sustainably. And it says organic palm oil is a primary ingredient in Dr. Bronner's soaps. Palm oil gives the bar its hardness and balances the lathering power of coconut oil while keeping the soap from softening and dissolving too fast. It says the palm oil is produced ethically from sustainably harvested palm fruits in Ghana's eastern region. We briefly talked about this last time around, Margie, but what would you say about a company like Bronner's that says the palm oil is produced ethically from a sustainably harvest palm fruits?
I actually did look at Dr. Bronner's just briefly, and we did not focus on Africa. And since I didn't look at, you know, specifically at the plantation or where it's coming from, I really can't comment on, you know, the Dr. Bronner's palm oils, you know, when and its origins and whether it's truly sustainable. But what I will say is that, you know, we looked at a number of plantations that had the The Roundtable on Sustainable Palm Oil Green Palm, you know, tree stamp. And we found children working there. We found women who had been raped in the fields there. So, you know, we raised this in the last piece that we did, where we kind of delved into this issue of the RSPO and sustainable palm oil. And, you know, I mean, it's certainly better to have something than nothing there that's trying to, you know, push this industry forward. But it's a hard task to do. And I do think that, you know, you just because it has a stamp of approval or it's been certified, it doesn't necessarily mean that there's not labor abuses going on at, you know, mills and plantations that are feeding into the supply chains of these brands that are members of the RSPO.
Well, thank you for the email, Philip. After the break, we'll actually talk more about this RSPO Green Palm logo and find out what else these companies are connected to. As today's guests report, the seal of approval, these companies are accused of continuing to grab land from indigenous people and destroying virgin rainforests. But we'll talk more about that after a break. We're joined today by Margie Mason and Robin McDowell. They are Associated Press investigative reporters, and they exposed widespread labor and human rights abuses in the palm oil industry, which is worth a whopping $65 billion. This is Your Calls One Planet series, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are talking about Associated Press investigations exposing widespread labor and human rights abuses in the palm oil industry. Palm oil is in everyday products and snacks. There's a long list in some of the reports written by Margie Mason and Robin McDowell, our guests today, who are investigative reporters with the AP. They write that while previous media reports have mostly focused on a single company or plantation, the AP investigation is the most comprehensive dive into labor abuses industry-wide. Before the break, Robin, we were talking about the RSPO Green Palm logo. And again, this is the Roundtable on Sustainable Palm Oil. You found that some of the companies that display this logo on their products continue to grab land from indigenous people and destroy virgin rainforests that are home to orangutans and other critically endangered species. They also contribute to climate change by cutting down trees, draining carbon-rich peatlands, and using illegal slash and burn clearing that routinely blankets part of Southeast Asia in a thick haze. Can you talk more about this label? And I mean, the thing is, we now buy products that have like 5 to 10 labels on them. And so how is someone supposed to know if this RSPO label is connected to a company that's grabbing land from indigenous people, for example?
Well, in our case, because the environmental devastation caused by palm oil has been covered so extensively, we really did not look at that as deeply. I mean, we both have witnessed it firsthand, having spent so many years in Indonesia, and it's clearly still a problem. I think that what the RSPO will say, and I believe there's truth to this, is that with new technology and satellite monitoring, you can see when palm oils are encroaching into virgin rainforest these days. And I think seizing land from indigenous populations is a little harder, but you can certainly see fires, you can see clearing. You don't have that benefit when it comes to labor. I mean, this is basically an army of workers that are hidden beneath the canopy of trees. So they haven't gotten many complaints about labor. I think, you know, of the more than 100 complaints on their complaint tracker, almost all of them have been about these land grabs and environmental destruction. But in the last couple of years, you have started to see the labor issues come up with greater awareness, more activity from the unions that are operating under very difficult conditions. So it's really a newer level of awareness, and I think you're going to see more of that.
Given that you were able to tell the stories of so many workers, on our last show, we talked about Zoom, who came to Malaysia to work on a plantation run by Felda, one of the world's largest palm oil companies. You both write, night after night, he has been forced to hide from authorities, sleeping on the jungle floor, exposed to the wind and the rain. Robin, have you been able to stay in touch with some of these workers to find out if anything has changed for them?
Well, in his particular case, he did make it back home to Indonesia. So he is back safe. I mean, he is already being harassed by brokers trying to get him to return to Malaysia with promises that, you know, things are going to be better this time. So of the people that we spoke to, those that were focused on in the story, and, you know, that's a rather small number compared to the overall number of people that we, especially Margie, spoke to, we do try to keep in touch with them through, you know, labor rights groups or people who, you know, in some cases help facilitate some of those meetings or getting onto plantations.
Margie, what is it like for labor rights groups in the area to keep track of all of this and to expose human rights and labor abuses?
I think it's really difficult. There's a number of local nonprofits that are working on this issue, but, you know, they've been kind of doing this for many years and almost quietly chipping away at it. And, you know, it's really quite difficult to get the attention. And so, you know, they're hoping now that the international media has kind of shined a spotlight on this, that it'll help their efforts as well. But it's a challenge because it's a huge industry, and it's also something that the governments are very protective over. This is, you know, a major crop, a major moneymaker, and the governments are extremely protective of it. And oftentimes there's backlash when anyone tries to criticize it in any way.
Well, you can email us if you have any questions for our guests today, Margie Mason and Robin McDowell, investigative reporters with the Associated Press. Your call at kalw.org. You can also give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. If you're on Twitter, you can also send a message there. We're at Your Call Radio. Margie, when you were on in late November, we spent quite a bit of time talking about what you uncovered in terms of how women are treated. And I mean, the stories were just horrific. As you said, this really applies to women all over the globe, though, and it's important to point that out. Because women work in very remote locations on these plantations and their supervisors are often male, it's just so easy for these men to exploit these women. And I hope you can take the time to read that piece and also watch the video. We didn't get enough time to talk about child labor. And in one of your follow-up pieces, I have to say your lead is just, the visuals are really amazing. You write, "Child labor and palm oil industry tied to Girl Scout cookies. They are two young girls from two very different worlds linked by a global industry that exploits an army of children." First, Margie, can you tell us about Olivia, as it Chafin, a Girl Scout in rural Tennessee?
Yeah, so Olivia, she's 14 years old now, but since she was around 11, she learned about palm oil and first learned about the environmental destruction. And she was very concerned about that and the lack, the loss of habitat for orangutans and other endangered species. And so she started looking at the back of her Girl Scout cookies that she was selling. She was a top seller in Tennessee in where she's from. And she saw the palm oil that was there, and she started asking questions. And she also saw the, RSPO label and, again, asked questions because it said mixed on the back. And Olivia really wanted to figure out what that meant and started really digging into it and realized that mixed means that certified palm oil is mixed with uncertified sustainable palm oil. And this was very problematic to her. And so she decided that she was going to stop selling the cookies. And she put up a petition and got other members in her troop to join as well. So she started this when she was 11, kind of, you know, it continued to kind of grow as she grew. But at this point, you know, she's very steadfast in her beliefs about, you know, palm oil should not be in the cookies.
And Robin, can you tell us about Ima, I-M-A? Is that how you say her name?
It's Ima, but I think Margie is the best person to talk to about Ima as well, because she met with her a few times.
Okay, so can you tell us about 10-year-old Ima, Margie?
So Ima is, you know, she and Olivia were roughly the same age. I think maybe Ima's a little bit older, but she was forced to drop out of the fourth grade to help her father, again, to meet these high quotas. And she was a very interesting little girl. She really loved going to school. And when I asked her if she missed it, she just immediately started crying. And she said, you know, I love going to school and I was the top of my class in math and I wanted to be a doctor and I really want to go back. And, you know, instead she was forced to work, you know, up to 12 hours a day. And, you know, she was just wearing flip-flops. She had no gloves. She showed me her hands and she said, you know, last night, you know, I couldn't sleep because I had been bitten the day before by a scorpion while I was, you know, picking up the palm kernels. So, you know, this is the reality for some of the children that we met. And, you know, I think for, you know, Robin and I, it was very heartbreaking, especially, you know, when the kids weren't able to get any education and some of them even had never been to school and didn't know how to read or write.
You write that with little or no access to daycare, some young children follow their parents to the fields where they come into contact with fertilizers and some pesticides that are banned in other countries. And as they grow older, they push wheelbarrows heaped with fruit two or three times their weight. Some weed and prune the trees barefoot, while teen boys may harvest bunches large enough to crush them, slicing the fruit from lofty branches with sickle blades attached to long poles. You actually have video of a young girl gathering palm kernels. I mean, she's just crouched down on the ground and just grabbing the fruit and tossing it in a basket. Robin, is there any way to know? I'm sure there isn't any way to know how many children are working on these palm oil plantations.
Well, again, these estimates, it's all estimates. And I think that kind of goes to show how low a priority this is for both governments. You know, we've had, if you're looking at Indonesia and looking at them just because they have the most workers, it's a much bigger country. And they at least have an idea of how many workers in general are on the plantation. So they say that's about 16 to 18 million. Around half of those are women. And there's very few women that don't have, you know, one or several children. So you can kind of, you can do the math that way and see that it is a very large number. And I think that the kids were really heartbreaking for both of us because their futures are being stolen. I mean, this is without the education and the, you know, the path that they have is really just to continue on these palm oil plantations, have children who then those children will work on the plantations. And it's just a cycle. It basically turns into a built-in workforce for these companies.
It was also just so sad to read about Abang, a 14-year-old who dropped out of the fifth grade to help his father on an Indonesian plantation. He's never tasted ice cream. Palm oil is in a lot of ice creams. He's accepted his own fate, you write, but still dreams of a better future for his little brother. Abang said, quote, "Let me work, just me helping my father. I want my brother to go back to school. I don't want him in the same difficult situation like me." This is just so devastating. This is a 14-year-old, Margie.
Yeah, he was another one. You know, there were so many of them that kind of, you know, touched us as we were interviewing them. But he was one that was really interesting, because when I asked, you know, I would always ask the kids, you know, what's your dream? If you could do anything, what would you do? And he actually said, you know, I don't really dare to dream anymore. This is my future, and I've accepted it. And I have to help my father. He was almost like, my father needs me. This is my role. I will accept this. However, I would like for my younger siblings to have something else. And, you know, this is part of the culture too, in, you know, that part of the world. I mean, you know, children help their parents, they help their families. You know, last time we talked about Jim and why he took that job and why he continued working under those horrible conditions in Malaysia. And it's because they need to make money to be able to help their families that are struggling, that are so poor, back home. And so, you know, children are the same. They see that there's a need to help. And, you know, that's just what they do. That's what's expected of them. You know, and in many cases, the parents may take the children to the fields, even though the company says it's not allowed. Now, oftentimes the company will know that the kids are being taken to the fields. But, you know, in cases even where it's banned, the parents will continue to go ahead and do so, just because, you know, they need the extra money, or they need to be able to meet these quotas.
You write that Indonesia has set up learning centers to help some of the children on plantations, but with such heavy workloads on the plantation, one instructor said he had to beg parents to let their sons and daughters come for even just a half day of classes. And many children, especially those living in remote areas, have no access to any type of education. And you quote Glorine Das, executive director of Tanajanita, thank you, a Malaysian nonprofit, who said, why aren't companies playing a role in setting up schools in collaboration with the government? Why are they encouraging the children to work instead? Were you able to ask the government officials about this, or any of the corporations about this, Margie?
So this is looking at the situation in Malaysia, and in particular looking at the situation with the kids who are in two of the bordering states on Borneo Island between Indonesia and Malaysia. And this is a very complicated, as you see in the story, long-standing, very complicated problem, where you have had all of these migrant workers who have come from Indonesia and the Philippines to Sarawak and Sabah states. And so then the parents are illegal migrants, or they don't have documents, and then they may have children. And these children are essentially then not given birth certificates, and they're essentially stateless. The Malaysian government will not allow them to have access to education or health care. And so I think one of the things that we found very surprising is that, you know, when another government from another country actually comes in and sets up schools across the border, because it's such a huge issue, I think that speaks volumes in itself, and sending in teachers from across the border. But these learning centers, again, there's not a whole lot of them compared to the number of children that are there that don't have access to school. And again, maybe even if they do have access, the parents still require them to come and work at least part of the day.
At the end of the piece, you quote Ima again, and she says, sometimes my friends ask me, why did you drop out? Why are you not at school? And she said, because I have to help my father. If you want to replace me and help my father, then I will go to school. How about that? And you report that Olivia learned about Ima, and she said now she's even more determined to fight on.
Yeah, so now Olivia is, you know, she basically was asking other Girl Scouts to kind of band with her on this issue, and to let, you know, Girl Scouts know that, you know, they're against this palm oil, or, you know, the mixed palm oil, and that they want more transparency. I think that's one of the things that Olivia was upset about, that she'd written letters and she had not received, you know, either responses or what she thought was an ample response. And, I think she wants to engage more on this issue. And as a Girl Scout, she sees it as, you know, it's part of their code to kind of try and do better. And she wants other Girl Scouts to band with her. And her petition that she has definitely gotten a lot more signatures.
Margie Mason and Robin McDowell are investigative reporters with the Associated Press, and they have exposed widespread labor and human rights abuses in the palm oil industry, which is worth a whopping $65 billion. 85% of the world's palm oil comes from Malaysia and Indonesia. It is in everyday products and snacks. Oreo cookies, which is owned by Nabisco, Kit Kat bars, which is owned by Nestle, Girl Scout cookies, as you've been hearing, personal care products from Procter & Gamble, a massive company, L'Oreal, Toms of Maine, which is now owned by Colgate, and the list is just very, very long. The banks that are pouring billions into this industry include Deutsche Bank, Citigroup, and HSBC. We're getting a lot of emails also just about the environmental devastation. Kathleen writes, one salient example is the wholesale destruction of virgin rainforests in Madagascar to plant palm oil trees, which has endangered so many species on the island. Kathleen and everyone else who's writing about the environmental destruction, we've done a few shows about that, and we will do that in the future. But Margie and Robin really wanted to shine a light on the exploitation of humans, because that piece of the story was not getting as much attention. Robin, going back to what people can do, I won't ask you that question again, but reading your series of pieces, we've done a lot of shows about the garment industry, how there's just so much exploitation from billion-dollar brands, and these women who are working ridiculous hours in Bangladesh and Vietnam and China. I mean, even in Los Angeles, we have garment workers who are undocumented, who do not make the minimum wage. And we've just been thinking a lot about human exploitation and what it will take at a time when we have so much information, social media, these companies are making more money than ever. The CEOs are making more money than ever. I mean, I guess it is a what will it take, but how do you think about this issue? Because it's so many industries exploit humans.
I think for me personally, like, I do believe it is hard to find clothing, products, anything at this point with this global economy that isn't in one way, one form or another, affected by trafficking, labor abuses, slavery. It's just, you know, when things get more expensive and you go to developing countries to produce, you are going to find desperate workers and a lack of rule of law to make sure that they're being protected. And like we were talking about with Ema and Abang as well, there's the go-to answer for the governments is this is, you know, customary, and the children help the workers, help the families. The kids don't feel that way if they haven't given up already. But I do think that companies, you've seen it with, you know, Apple, for instance. They had a big problem with the suicides at Foxconn. They went in and actually, you know, demanded that auditors go into those factories. And from my understanding, things are actually a lot better. When the companies want to make sure that their reputation isn't being hurt by this, they can find a way to make sure that, you know, that they know what's going on in the factories, that there's a complaint system, that they have people, third parties that are not connected to the government or to the factories themselves that can help audit. It's really just a willingness. And, you know, I think most people are willing to pay a little bit more for products. It doesn't take that much more. It's just, they're used to getting this for cheap for a long time. They want to make as much money as possible. And until they're shamed into demanding change, I think they just keep doing it.
Thank you for that. We'll definitely do a show updating people about what's going on at those Foxconn factories. Margie, what would you add? We have about 2 minutes left.
I agree with what Robin said. I do think that, it's important for people to obviously understand and think about why the things that they're buying in the store. I mean, we did this with the seafood industry too. I mean, why can you buy a can of tuna for 99 cents in the store? You know, labor is a huge cost for any industry. And so, you know, if you can eliminate or really, really shrink down the labor costs on things, then, you know, that's more profit. And, you know, I think we have to, as consumers, ask ourselves, you know, are we willing to pay more for things? And I'm not sure a lot of people would say that they are. I think that's a question that needs to be asked, though, because, you know, if we are willing to pay more for things, then, you know, that is something that can be put forward, you know, to the companies. But right now, I think the companies are looking at their bottom line. And, you know, palm oil is cheap and there's a lot of it and it's easy. So, you know, there's going to need to be a lot of pressure and sustained pressure to change it.
Are you planning any follow-ups at this point?
I think we're going to be definitely looking to see what, if any action happens. And certainly, you know, we are definitely keeping our eyes on the industry. We don't have any major, we had three major pieces to the investigation. So we don't have another major piece planned, but that's not to say that we won't do something if it pops up.
Marjorie Mason is an investigative reporter with the Associated Press. Margie, thank you so much for joining us and thank you so much for your work.
Thank you.
Robin McDowell is also an investigative reporter with the AP. Thank you for your work, Robin, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much. You can find the pieces that they wrote along with a few videos at yourcallradio.org. They note that Nestle, Unilever, which owns a lot of everyday brands, and L'Oreal were among the companies that noted they had stopped purchasing directly from Felda or its commercial affiliates, but they did not hear back from so many other major companies. Many refused to say or provide any information about, you know, even when palm oil was clearly listed on the label. Some companies like IKEA, Colgate, Palmolive confirmed the use of palm oil or derivatives in their products. And you can find those pieces at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Thanks to Joanne Marr and Kevin Vance for keeping our studio running and engineering the show. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.